The Capital Investment Committee hearing for February 8th is called to order. Members, today will be the last day that we hear overviews from our state agencies, and so today we have six agencies on the agenda with 15 minutes allocated for each. First is the Minnesota Zoo. Welcome, Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm John Frawley, Director of the Minnesota Zoo. Should I proceed?
Proceed.
With me today is Missy McGrath, our Legislative Director, Dr. Annie Rivas, Director of Animal Health, and Thomas Rutt, our Project Manager of some of the projects we're going to go over today. So first of all, Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the time today to give you an update on the needs of the Minnesota Zoo. I thought I'd first start just going over the mission of the Minnesota Zoo and kind of an overview of our beloved zoo here in Minnesota. Our mission is to connect people to animals in the natural world to save wildlife. A lot of people refer to the zoo as the new zoo, but our zoo is 44 years old now, so it's been around quite a while. Opened in 1978. It's a 500-acre zoo, which a lot of people don't realize we're the fifth largest zoo in the country. The average zoo in our country is usually less than 40 or 50 acres. We're 500 acres, which is a great place to be a modern zoo. We're home to over 5,000 animals. We serve over 1.3 million guests annually, and over 40,000 household members of the zoo. So the zoo is beloved and has had those types of numbers since we've opened. It's a unique state agency with the fact that approximately one-third of our funding comes from the state of Minnesota. Two-thirds of our funding is brought through earned revenue, business operations, retail, food, events. So really we have to have a strong business model to run the zoo. Part of us is like our own Main Street type situation where we really have to have a smart model to make the zoo work. But it's a great public-private partnership and it's done well. So Mr. Chair, I'd like to go into our request.
Please proceed.
So today I brought with two experts that are working on two specific projects for the Minnesota Zoo. These are critical emergency projects. We've been testifying and putting these projects forward for over 3 years. We like to say at the Minnesota Zoo, we really focus on what the zoo really needs. The first of the two critical projects, and I also say a lot of people ask me a lot of times, what's the most important project? And my answer this year is both, just because of the nature of both these projects. They have to do with human safety, they have to do with animal safety, and they've been delayed for so many years. So the first project is our animal hospital. It's over 47 years old. It was built before the zoo was opened. It has huge structural and animal and human need challenges, which our head veterinarian will outline here shortly. It's a $10 million request, but we are planning to match that with private funding. The zoo's been very successful raising private funds as well. And so this is the type of project we think we can ask for a match and do half with support from the state and half with private funding. The second project is an asset preservation project. We call it the Lakeside Plaza. For those of you who have been to the Minnesota Zoo, our main lake is right in the middle of the zoo. There's huge infrastructure walkway around the lake. It's the egress and access for the heart of the zoo. Over the last 10 years, structural engineering reports have shown us and told us the story of how that's crumbling. It's a cantilevered cement structure that at some point is not going to be able to bear the needs of access, egress, fire, emergencies, and just general public. So we'll hear more about that. Because of the unique nature of these two requests, I have asked two of our zoo experts to come in and kind of go over those more specifically. And then at that point, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll answer any questions. So with that, I'd like to ask if we could have Dr. Annie Rivas talk about the Animal Hospital Project.
Dr. Rivas, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Director Frawley. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Dr. Ann Rivas. I am the Director of Animal Health at the Minnesota Zoo. Our veterinary team at the Minnesota Zoo has the privilege of providing medical care for more than 4,000 animals at the zoo. On any given day, our team can find themselves participating in the medical care of wildlife for state conservation efforts, such as the rehabilitation of wild trumpeter swans, performing surgical procedures on a southern stingray, or immobilizing a moose for a dental. Although our veterinary team has the ability to provide medical care for a wide variety of species, it is our medical facilities that continue to impede our abilities to perform our jobs as veterinarians to the fullest. Our animal hospital is over 47 years old, and in the last several years, we've had to put a lot of resources into the building to help keep our medical team running. The top picture on the left is our current surgical suite. Given the building design, it is impossible to keep this as a truly clean operating room, which increases the risk of infection for our patients. The bottom left picture shows our current veterinary team during a ruminotomy surgery on an anesthetized goat from our farm. As you can see, there is very little space for our team to move around, and the room lacks the specialized equipment and technology needed to meet the current standard of care in veterinary medicine. With larger animals, such as the Malayan tapir on the right, our team typically performs medical procedures in the field on the ground instead of transporting to a sterile surgical suite or treatment room due to space limitations and facility limitations. This not only increases the risk of potential infections during surgery, but it also leads to an increased risk of staff injuries from stooping, bending, and moving heavy animals without the proper equipment. Our examination room, pictured in these on this slide, has not changed significantly since it was built in 1976, as you can see in the picture on the left. And even back then, space was limited. This is the heart of our hospital. It's the room that our veterinarians and veterinary nurses utilize daily for clinical exams of everything from sharks to Przewalski horses. The room not only serves as our basic examination room, but it also is having to multipurpose as our radiology suite that houses our x-ray machine. Our animal health team is used to making it work in this space, but that results in challenges with workflow, limited number of procedures that can be done per day, and often having to transport animals outside the zoo to acquire current standard of care for diagnostic imaging and treatments. This morning, I was actually off-site doing a CT scan on a sea turtle because of this. This decreases our team's efficiency and increases our operational expenses. These are further pictures of our hospital, with the photo on the left showing our aged outdoor holding space. Our team currently does not even utilize this space due to safety concerns, both for the animals and for the staff. Further, this winter, with the heavy snowfall, some of this infrastructure collapsed. This greatly limits our ability to hospitalize sick animals and provide fresh air for the animals that are staying with us. The photo on the right shows our unloading dock area. As you can see, our current hospital does not have a place for transitioning animals from a vehicle into the hospital itself, which results in an increased risk when transporting dangerous animals due to the lack of secondary containment. It also provides challenges when we're working in adverse weather conditions, such as ice, and lacks the control of lighting during moves after hours. In fact, one of our veterinarians actually slipped on black ice out here 2 weeks ago, sustaining a concussion and neck injury, and has been on light duty ever since. Thus, hospital project is truly a matter of both human and animal health and safety. If funded, this project would create industry standard facilities, including an intensive care unit for the animals housed at the zoo. It would provide proper infection quarantine and isolation spaces to better control for infections and biosecurity risks within the zoo animal population. It would better protect human and animal safety. It would allow us to support veterinary education and provide opportunities for collaboration and strategic partnerships. This project is not only critical to improve the medical care that our veterinary team is able to provide every day, but it is also critical in attracting and retaining an excellent and talented veterinary team.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, we'd switch to the second project and have Thomas Root with us today.
Director Root, please identify yourself and proceed.
Tom Root, Project Management Director at the Minnesota Zoo. Thanks, Chair. Thank you, committee members and John. Again, I'm Thomas Root, Project Management Director at the Minnesota Zoo. I'm a licensed professional engineer in the state of Minnesota. The bulk of my engineering experience comes from evaluating and designing structures. I'm here to talk about the Lakeside Plaza project, to give you a little history on what this is, and John did a good job of kind of describing it already, but it's a 45-year-old infrastructure that connects the zoo to its main lake and serves as a main accessible public circulation and exiting pathway. It's roughly 500 feet long. It's about 20 to 40 feet wide, and it has a large 300-foot ramp, kind of a switchback concrete ramp that's not pictured in this image here. It serves as the roof to some sensitive mechanical and animal care spaces. The macaque holding, or snow monkey holding, is directly below this. Significant deterioration began to become a problem in the early 2010s, at which time a series of condition assessments and repairs have been conducted. As you can see in some of these pictures, we needed to do some investigations. Structural investigation determined that water intrusion was the main factor contributing to the varied forms of deterioration that we're seeing here. The zoo performed many minor improvements and kind of retrofits to try to stop some of the deterioration. We also then did a brand new concrete topping and waterproof barrier on the surface 4 years ago, to protect the underlying structure. Despite this, continued deterioration occurred, resulting in a recent load and gathering limit to the area and additional further repairs. Despite these efforts, deterioration continues and threatens the eventual closure of the asset, resulting in significant circulation and exiting ramifications to the public. In the last year, we've experienced multiple trip and fall injuries to the public in this area that could correlate to some of the damage perpetuating through the structure and into the walkway. The left image shows prevalent reinforcement corrosion leaching through the concrete, resulting in very large cracks and concrete loss. The center image shows approximately 4 inches of structural movement, which resulted in differential structural movement between the two panels that should not be there. It results in significant cracks and material loss in the walking surface above. The right image here shows additional large cracks and reinforcement corrosion. Below those large cracks will eventually fall into the water below. Funding for this project will address a number of things. It's going to address safety issues for our staff, volunteers, and guests. It will repair and stabilize part of the infrastructure that can be repaired and replace what can't be repaired. It'll fix the existing ramp and stairs between our upper plaza and this lakeside plaza with a ADA-compliant walkway, compliant with modern ADA codes. It'll improve views of the lake and our macaque exhibit. It'll remodel sensitive areas beneath this as we take the structure off in order to replace it. We'll need to remodel the spaces within that have been damaged by water intrusions. Those include a few mechanical spaces and our snow monkey holding space. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to turn it back over to John.
So, Mr. Chair, committee members, that summarizes our two requests for this year. The Animal Hospital Project, a $10 million request. The Lakeside Replacement Project, a $15.12 million request. Like I said, it's our job to make sure we keep our Minnesota Zoo world-class. These projects have been out there for quite a while. We really want to address them. Time does matter. They both have human and health of safety issues with both animals and staff. So we're doing our best to push these forward and would like your support. So, Chair, open to any questions you might have.
Members, any questions?
No.
Seeing none, thank you. Or Representative Zhang.
I'm just curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who's now the, I know that Representative Hewitt used to be the member representing Minnesota Zoo. Who now represents Minnesota Zoo?
Correct. Director Frawley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Hewitt, Representative Bierman will be helping us with this project.
I'll give him my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Frawley, and thank you, Dr. Rivas, Director Roop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have the Commissioner Rukavina from the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation. So while they get ready, Representative Ryer, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 6th?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes for February 6th.
Representative Ryan moves an approval of the minutes for February 6th. Members, any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for February 6th are approved. Commissioner, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Lee, members of the House Capital Investment Committee. For the record, my name is Ida Rukavina. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation. Thank you for the opportunity to present the this project and our agency's capital budget request. I'm here today with Linda Johnson, Director of Property Development with our agency. Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation is a regional economic development agency established in 1941 by Governor Harold Stassen and the legislature, so it's a little over 82 years old. The agency was created to diversify the economy of a region largely dependent on a natural resource-based economy, primarily iron mining. The agency's mission is to invest resources to foster vibrant growth and economic prosperity in northeastern Minnesota, to enhance livable communities, maximize collaborations and partnerships, and to strengthen businesses and worker education. We have here the Minnesota statute that recognizes our agency. In 1973, this statute was added to our agency authority. Minnesota Statute 298.22 Subdivision 1C provides our agency the ability to develop resources in northeastern Minnesota, which includes tourism. And part of that tourism is Giants Ridge, which we're here today to talk about. The agency owns the Giants Ridge Recreation Area. It's managed by a management company, Guest Services, which manages all of Giants Ridge's operations, including golf, ski, rental, retail, concession, and facilities. Giants Ridge is utilized by approximately 130 high schools across the state, specifically those with alpine ski, Nordic ski, or golf teams. And each year, Giants Ridge hosts events, resulting in nearly 3,500 Minnesota school athletic visits and 135,000 facility visits overall. The facility provides our local citizens, students, and other visitors access to quality recreational opportunities and amenities that improve their quality of life. In addition, this facility creates a $55 million annual economic impact. Just a little bit of history of this facility. In 1959, there was a group of private stakeholders that founded Giants Ridge as a local ski hill. In 1980, there was a deep mining recession, and that hit the Iron Range. There was a lot of layoffs. It hit the Iron Range, and Giants Ridge fell into bankruptcy. And later in 1980, in an effort to diversify the economy of the Iron Range and create jobs, the agency paid off the mortgage and debt and bought Giants Ridge for $68,000. Over the past 39 years, the agency, as well as private developers, have shared in the investments at Giants Ridge of over $120 million, with private investment being over half of that amount. The economic impact, again, is $55 million annually. Today, our agency's request is for $16.6 million. This is to replace the failing underground infrastructure at Giants Ridge Recreation Area, which is a state asset located in northern Minnesota. The water line replacement will sustain the facility's recreational operations and provide suppression services. Giants Ridge, being a state-owned asset, our facility's goals are to create economic impacts in northern Minnesota, provide recreational facilities to enhance the quality of life, attract private sector development, and operate as a year-round recreational destination. Giants Ridge attracted nearly 135,000 visits in fiscal year 2022 from Minnesota, the United States, and Canada. Private residential and lodging facilities have been built within the recreation area boundaries, which also increased the local tax base. And the total annual visits in fiscal year 22 were 134,900. In winter, we have 88,772, and that is with our season ski pass numerator. In summer, we had 31,089 visitors with golf rounds at the two golf facilities, the Quarry and the Legend. And then there were other visits. We have events, summer mountain biking, summer chairlift rides, disc golf, climbing walls, summer rentals, and tubing. Giants Ridge has a substantial impact on the economy and quality of life in northern Minnesota. The 2023 capital budget request would impact many population segments in the region and the state of Minnesota. Giants Ridge is located in Biwabik, which is on the eastern end of the Iron Range, and it is a major economic development driver. It diversifies the economy in the agency's service area. In 2019, Giants Ridge supported 179 jobs, including 133 full-time employees. The jobs are required to operate the recreation and private lodging facilities. So regarding the current project that we're here, the existing water line pipes are over 35 years old. They've reached a crisis level of corrosion, damage, and deterioration. Without this project, the facility will soon be unable to make snow that supports our winter operations, and it is key to the region's economy. Giants Ridge is the region's recreational centerpiece, and it's a major economic driver in our tourism industry. The corrosion of the existing pipes can lead to eventual water leaking, which is not only inefficient, but can also contribute to wasting our natural resources. So investing in this new waterline infrastructure will lead to greater sustainability and more efficient use of our state's natural resources. This waterline replacement will replace 90% of those pipes and automate 60% of the 35-year failing underground infrastructure and snowmaking system. There's 36,000 linear feet of pipe that will be replaced and upgraded for the snowmaking system. The snowmaking is the production of snow by forcing water and pressurized air through a snow machine on the ski slopes. Snowmaking has become critical to smaller ski areas that need to provide consistent snow in order to remain competitive. And the waterline replacement project will increase efficiencies by maximizing the pump station to capacity. It will reduce water costs by 30%, and it will be 40% more energy efficient than our current system. Cost savings will be attained through reduced repair costs, resulting in decreased downtime caused by equipment failure. And safety for employees will be improved through automation by limiting the hazards associated with manual transport, staging, and connecting of the snow machines. Snowmaking machines have also been used to slow the spread of wildfires. In September of 2021, firefighters struggled to contain a 204,000-acre wildfire and prevent hundreds of homes and two of California's most famous ski resorts, Heavenly and Kirkwood, from being destroyed. Workers at both ski resorts ran dozens of snowmaking machines around the clock to soak building and surrounding areas in an attempt to stop the advancing fire. As our nation experiences more wildland fires, the ski industry is increasingly using snowmaking machines to try and minimize the risk and damage from major fires. Should the emergency ever arise near the East Iron Range, Giants Ridge could potentially be in a position to offer that same assistance through the snowmaking system. Our agency has initiated several bonding requests over the past few years. It is critical that the infrastructure needs at Giants Ridge be addressed through this year's capital budget request. It is now the time to act and help support this continued diversification of northeastern Minnesota's economy. Thank you, Chairman Lee and members of the House Capital Investment Committee for the opportunity to present this project and our agency's capital budget request. Again, as always, I would like to welcome all of you to come and visit the Iron Range, come and see this facility or any others that we have. Thank you again for the time and opportunity, and we will welcome any questions that you may have.
Members, any questions? Commissioner Representative Scrava.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, have there been many private sector development over the years at Giants Ridge?
Commissioner.
Chairman Lee, Representative Scrava, Yes, there has been, and actually I'll turn it over to Director Johnson to get into more specifics.
Director Johnson, please identify yourself and proceed.
Linda Johnson, Chairman Lee, committee members. Yes, over the last 30 plus years, we bought the facility in 1984. We've invested over $120 million in the facility to grow it out, again, to diversify the economy. But also we've attracted a lot of private sector development, a couple being the lodge at Giants Ridge, the villas at Giants Ridge. These are primarily private sector developments, as well as a single family housing development adjacent across the lake, which is a 250 single-family housing development, which has continued on and is slowly developing, opened up in about 2007-08, and then the real estate market went into a downslide. So now it's just elevating back up, and the continued build-out of the single-family homes adds to the tax base for the city of Biwabik and the town of White. So again, our investment attracts additional private sector development, and it really helps that economic wheel on the Iron Range, particularly the east end of the Iron Range, continue to grow that economic impact. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director or Commissioner, so this being a state asset, I'm curious to know, what is the IRRR doing to ensure that people of all means in the state of Minnesota can access this facility, whether they have the financial means or not?
Thank you, Chairman Lee. So primarily it is a ski hill, but throughout the years it has expanded. So we have bike trails. People do pay season's passes for either the Nordic skiing or the downhill skiing. I'll turn it over to Linda in a minute for the mountain biking. There's also tubing and some of the activities that we do are the area schools. They participate in sixth grade. You know, the classes get to come on field trips and experience skiing, even if they're maybe not a family that, skis on their own. There's also hiking opportunities and different trail systems that are available. And I will turn it over to Director Johnson about the mountain biking.
Director Johnson.
Chairman Lee, committee members, we have a variety of programs at the facility in the winter and the summer that we do a program with Courage Kenny. It's for skiers with disabilities. They are based out of Duluth. They come on Sundays up to the facility. It's been a huge success. Also, we have discounted rates during certain times of the year so that we are assuring that everybody has access across the entire state. We also work with the First Nations, and we have a large ski population that comes from Winnipeg in Canada and up in Fort Frances. And primarily those groups come in March because it's generally warmer in northeastern Minnesota in March. And so we really attract a wide variety of folks and offer a lot of different types of programs and pricing so that we're assuring that Minnesotans and Canadians, for that matter, across our region in the Midwest have access to be able to participate in the sports and the activities that we offer. Thank you.
Director, do you charge a fee for the school-aged children that takes programming, or do you provide financial assistance to any of them?
Chairman Lee, committee members, yes, we have the grade school programs, and across the country and throughout Minnesota as well, there's what used to be called the sixth grade program, where we provide access to all elementary children at a very reduced rate so that they can come as a class and experience skiing during the winter, and it's been very successful over the years, and as well as homeschool groups. So we attract a wide variety of homeschool groups as well, and again, those are all at a very discounted rate so they can have their rentals and their ski lessons and then enjoy the rest of the day after they've taken their lesson and learned the safety protocols that are involved with getting onto a chairlift or a conveyor belt so that they can learn to ski. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, and to Commissioner and our testifier. I wanted to chime in and say, one, applaud you. I like seeing the multiple uses as we look at the impacts of climate change and wildfire, being able to use that snow machines to work with the community and support. I'm curious, in terms of looking at the critical infrastructure needs, we know, the impact of tourism and that this has on families and local economy, but also a regional economy. And I'm curious on the impacts of equipment failure, Could you talk a bit about what that looks like in terms of when equipment might be down because of the level of disrepair that it's fallen into, and what, how the length of time or what you're seeing for folks who are actually trying to access Giants Ridge and the services?
Commissioner?
Chairman Lee, Representative Kalsowski, thank you for the question. I will start off, and again, Director Johnson, having a little bit more experience, I can finish if I miss anything. So the equipment, the snowmaking equipment, and why it's so important to this facility is that, you know, in the fall time when we're ramping up and it's getting cold, we're using that snowmaking equipment to start the base for the ski hill. You know, right now it's February 8th. You know, it's cold enough that once we have that snow, we're not making snow, you know, in typical years. But having that equipment running in the, in, you know, late October, our goal is always to open the Thanksgiving weekend. That's typically when we open in a normal year. And that snowmaking equipment is critical to providing the base so that we can open and get going. Because, again, depending on the ski season, it's, there's only so many months, and we want to be open and getting the most impact. Our typical busiest weeks are in December over the holidays, and so having that equipment up in early December and it running is very important for us. The downtimes, I'm not sure.
Dr. Johnson.
Chairman Lee, committee members, yes, the snowmaking process is generally about 30 days, right? You like to stay in a window, and that's what this new system will do. We've got the critical, you know, pipes that are crumbling underground, and every time we have a line down, it's really downtime, and it shortens our ability to create that revenue stream, right? Our sweet spots are Christmas, right? So it's all the major holidays. In the ski season, generally across the state of Minnesota, it averages between 110 to 120 days average, right? And we've looked at our financials, and usually, you know, there's about 35 to 40 days in a ski season where you really make the bulk of your revenue. So being open for Christmas, Thanksgiving, the, you know, President's Weekend, Martin Luther King, all of those are really major economic drivers. And I would say probably to the tourism market in general, you really in the winter have a short season. And as the weather, the seasons on summer and winter, they get shorter, it's more important that we can continue on once we start making snow and not stop the process. Thank you.
Representative Kozlowski.
Yeah, thank you so much for just illuminating what that looks like. We know that short window of time and how critical it is to be able to capture revenue and be able to connect our youth and tribal nations and everybody trying to access Trans Ridge.
Representative Libby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Just a quick question. At one time, I think you were hosting the high school league events in cross country, I believe, or maybe downhill as well. Or is that, I missed some of the presentation, I'm sorry, but are you doing that still today?
Commissioner.
Commissioner Lee, Representative, thank you. Yes, we are still doing that, and it might have been on one of my slides, but just this past week, Director Jones, we had the Alpine Ski Regionals, and so we have the Nordic Ski Teams, the high school ski leagues, and we also have some of the other youth that aren't maybe in the high school, the D team, and are they outside of that? The
right.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you host any of the high school mountain biking events as well, or not so much?
Director Johnson.
Chairman Lee, committee members, we are working to get on that list. So one of our projects, and not to pivot, the Redhead Mountain Biking Park that we've invested in Chisholm has attracted the Minnesota State High School Mountain Biking League, which is new to the state of Minnesota. And Giants Ridge is working towards that. Again, huge economic impact for the Alpine and the cross-country state meets that we have because it, again, brings people to our region. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my son is a mountain biker, so I appreciate that question there. He's raced at Spirit Mountain before, and they call it Puker Hill. So I'm trying to rack my brains here. When was the last time? I feel like there was something in the more recent years that we had bought some snow equipment, or the state had purchased some snow equipment. Do you recall when the last time that was? And then my next question, I'll just follow up right away. How long is the snow equipment designed to last? I have a ski hill in my district, Andes Hills, Tower Hills, so we don't get bonding dollars for our ski hill. So I'm just kind of curious.
Chairman, Commissioner.
Representative Franson, this is the only request that we have gone for bonding. We have not, I don't know the specifics again. I am being a new commissioner, but my understanding is we have not had bonding requests for snowmaking equipment. Director Johnson.
Representative Franson, I think you may be mentioning an appropriations we had in the 2020 bonding bill for Ramsey County for Andy Lee. We'll be looking for that name. And it was not for equipment. And Representative Lilly was the chief author of the bill. So Representative Lilly, if you want to briefly talk about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's in Representative Zhang's district, and it's an amazing asset in the East Metro. We didn't have any skiing opportunities in the East. All the kids from the East Metro had to go to the West. But there's, it's also sledding and snowshoeing and everything. But it did not go to snowmaking. It's more in this case. It was facilities. So other funds covered snowmaking part of it, but Legacy had a little bit of in the skin, and then this committee had some money invested into the facility.
Representative Franz, the last follow-up on this topic.
I'm trying to get Representative Zhang to come and go sliding with me.
Representative Franson.
Nobody wants to see me sliding. I just feel like that we had some sort of a floor fight about Giants Ridge in the last 10 years. So we did? Okay. Representative Hansen knows. Okay.
So maybe you and Representative Hansen could touch base offline on this. Thank you. Commissioner.
Chairman Lee, I did the second part of your question of like how long the I didn't know if it was equipment would last, but the these pipes are the original ones from like 1980 early 80s, so we are hoping with this replacement that they will be another long-term investment.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Director, for coming before us. Next on the agenda, we have the Minnesota Historical Society Director Whitworth and Kelleher. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Lee and Vice Chair Ryer, members of the Capital Investment Committee. My name is Kench Whitworth, and I serve as Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. With me today is my colleague David Kelleher, our Director of Public Policy and Government Relations. Today we'd like to provide a brief background and context of who we are, what we do, and where we're going. We'll also review our capital budget priorities, and as time allows, we'll provide some brief updates on exciting projects that have been previously funded. Mr. Chair, when working with this committee, we often focus on bricks and mortar, the nitty-gritty of asset preservation projects. And we think it's equally important to talk about what takes place inside these buildings and on these sites that the Minnesota Historical Society manages on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I think most of us know that there is no substitute for going to the place and standing on the spot, a spot of historical significance. The Minnesota Historical Society is a statewide organization. We serve Minnesotans across the state, representing all walks of life. Our mission statement explains not only our approach to our work, but I think also articulates why history matters. I believe it's on your screen, so I won't read it, but I will just lean into this being an aspirational mission statement that was adopted about 18 months ago. But as an organization, we are fully committed to making this a reality. As we emerge from the pandemic, the resulting changes and certainly lessons learned, we are guided by a new strategic plan and four strategic imperatives that you see on the slide. I will just touch on the four of them very briefly: transforming access, really refers not only to continuing to engage existing audiences in more meaningful ways, but perhaps even more important is attracting new audiences and removing barriers so that all Minnesotans can access MNHS content and programming. And that includes a variety of audiences, certainly K-12, Mr. Chair, as we have discussed, K-12 students across the state and even in our own backyard. The second imperative is re-envisioning space. We define that as pushing history to all corners of the state. And a key to that is building collaborative relationships within communities and sharing knowledge back and forth and building a network of advocacy to advance heritage preservation across Minnesota. The third imperative is one that's particularly near and dear to my heart. It's expanding expertise and authority. At the heart of that, in my view, is encouraging a better understanding of how history is created. Frankly, what history is, what history isn't. And another important part of that is to provide space, both online and in person, for critical reflection individually and at the community level on the ways history informs contemporary issues. And then fourth, the last strategic imperative in our current plan is creating a sustainable future. At its core, this imperative is all about alignment. Alignment of our programmatic resources, our human resources, and our financial resources. With that, I will hand off to my colleague, David Kelleher, to take a quick look at our 2023 capital requests.
Director Kelleher, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Kelleher with the Minnesota Historical Society, and thank you for having us in today. This year, we are bringing forward three capital budget requests that you can see here on the slide. We will take a moment to discuss each one: Historic Sites Asset Preservation, History Center Enhancement Pre-Design, and the County and Local Historic Preservation Grant Program. The network of historic sites around the state are a statutory responsibility of the Minnesota Historical Society. They are in Chapter 138, and taking care of these buildings is a state responsibility. Therefore, we are responsible for 150 structures in 26 sites across the state, and nearly half of those structures are over 100 years old, providing us some challenges with maintaining those historic buildings and maintaining historic standards that are the National Park Service, Department of the Interior standards, as well as state standards for preserving historic structures. On the other hand, we have modern visitor centers that are not historic buildings, but are coming to their life cycle, visitor centers that were built in the last 30, 40 years, where some of the elements of those structures, the heating and cooling systems, the roofs, are needing to be replaced, or in some cases, the buildings themselves need to be replaced. This diagram gives you a sense of how we see our inventory of buildings and how we calculate the replacement cost. Think of this image as a bucket of water, and the wear and tear on buildings is 3 to 4% each year. And if we don't replace that water into the bucket through asset preservation and normal maintenance, the bucket runs out. The facilities are in poor condition. We come to this analysis through the archivist system and the facility condition audit, the FCAs that you hear other agencies talking about. So we get to that 3 to 4% wear and tear based on the replacement value of those facilities. And if you look at that 4% as compared to our request and what has been provided, we are falling behind. So on this image, the 4% amounts to approximately $14 million each year. And the bars on the left of this graph show the 2020 appropriation of about $2.3 million and the 20-year average for asset preservation. And those are biennial totals, as you do bonding bills every other year, 20-year average of just under $4 million. So this demonstrates how we're falling behind. These bars on this graph show, again, the 2020 appropriation and then our requests for 6 years out from here. Mr. Chair, this is a list of the individual projects within our asset preservation request. They are in priority order, and in the governor's recommendation, there was an inflation factor, as with other agencies, to reflect the increased cost of doing these projects at this time. I'm going to take a very, very quick run through of some images of recently completed projects, projects that are in process, and projects that are in this current request. And I hope this gives you some inspiration both for your personal and family summer travels, as well as your committee's trips in the summer and fall to some of these great historic sites. Mr. Chair, I know that you all like to stop at Split Rock Lighthouse in September, and we would really, really welcome another visit up there. These are statewide projects at historic sites across the state, a number of them at Mill City Museum in Minneapolis, Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, Split Rock Lighthouse on the North Shore, Folsom House, Ramsey House, and many, many more. Even though we've recently completed a visitor center at historic Fort Snelling, there's still a great deal of work to be done at Fort Snelling for the historic structures inside the fort, or the diamond, as we call it. More work to be done there. Kelly Farm up in Elk River, the Kelly Farm House needs some work on the exterior. Again, here's our list provided in the handout for you. And Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back to Kent.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second component in our capital budget request is a request to re-envision the future of the Minnesota History Center. It may come as a surprise to some of you that last fall, actually in October, we celebrated the 30th anniversary of the Minnesota History Center. Our colleagues in the Department of Administration do a magnificent job of caring for that building, so sometimes we have to convince people of the age of the facility. Nevertheless, we are now thinking about the next 30 to 50 years of that building. If you think about a building that was designed in the 1980s and was constructed in the late 80s, early 90s, think about some major developments that impact such facilities. We think about changes in security after 9/11. We think about the dramatic explosion in technology and all those developments that impact the work we do at the Minnesota History Center. And then most recently, the challenges of the pandemic and social distancing and how people want to engage in public spaces. So those are the types of issues that we are thinking about, as well as mission and programmatic delivery. We are doing master planning, and our request in this capital budget is for $500,000 for pre-design of rethinking of the existing footprint of the Minnesota History Center. It isn't a true expansion project as much as it is a reimagining, a re-envisioning of the current footprint and how we can maximize that square footage as we serve Minnesotans and the coming generation. I'll hand back to David for the final piece of our request.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our third and final request is the County and Local Historic Preservation Grant Program. This program provides funding for cities and counties to take care of their most important historic structures. This is a competitive grant program that requires a match from the local entity receiving the funding. This program has been in existence since the 1990s, funded most funding years, but not all, and has helped cities and counties take care of their most important historic structures, libraries, city halls, county courthouses, and other historic facilities in their communities. The governor's recommendation on that was $900,000 for that grant program.
Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to address questions.
Members, any questions? So, Director Kelleher, I think you forgot one of my homework that I have asked of you, and I would still ask of you, after our hearing from Legacy and identifying some projects that were located in the city of Minneapolis that I did not know of, I would ask for you, of all of our members at the table, if you could help us identify any historical assets or structure so that, when we start planning our tours in the fall, we could possibly visit them too.
Mr. Chair, I've started on the homework assignment. I've got a really good list started. Members, what we're talking about is there was a project that was funded from legacy funds in South Minneapolis. If you were to drive by the building today, you would think it's a nondescript industrial building, which it is, but there's a hidden history there. And that building was a fire station, Station 24, that was a segregated fire station. And African-American firefighters worked there for a number of years and served that community. And there's a group today that is working to share that story and preserve the building. So that building holds a great deal of history for people to learn about. What I've done is collected in each of your districts what I think, and I'll ask some of my colleagues who know more about this than I do, what some hidden histories are or things that would make you say, huh, I never knew that. And I've got a list started, and as we come around to visit with you one-on-one, I'll see what you think the, huh, I never knew about that in your district or your region might be. And, Mr. Chair, I hope you'll visit some of those spots on your tours this fall, and as well as some of the sites that we operate. And I would also mention that one of the sources for information for that is we run a site called Minipedia. It's not as expansive as Wikipedia, but it is very thoroughly researched, documented and vetted on hundreds and hundreds of topics of Minnesota history. So that is a go-to source for a lot of information about hidden history or everyday history that you might want to learn about. So, Mr. Chair, I've got the homework assignment. I didn't turn it in yet. I don't want to get an incomplete, but it's on its way.
Thank you, Director, and thank you, Director Woodward, for your presentation today. To really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have the Department of Natural Resources. We have Commissioner Schroman. Welcome. Commissioner, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Lee and members of the committee. I'm Sarah Stroman. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And with me here today is Samantha Minkler. Samantha is our capital asset manager at the department. So I'm going to do my best in the time allotted to give you an overview of what is really an enormous portfolio of capital assets. To talk about what those assets mean to Minnesotans across the state, including in each of your districts, and then present our 2023 bonding request. And Ms. Minkler is here to help answer any questions or provide any additional details. So before we get into the request, I do just want to provide a little bit of context to the department's capital asset portfolio. And I think this is really important because in contrast to a lot of the project-based requests you're hearing from other agencies, you're going to hear something that is a little bit more programmatically focused from us. And that is because our capital asset portfolio is really unique from other state agencies, other state entities. First of all, it is incredibly diverse. And so you all probably are aware of those kinds of assets that are really visible to you and to the public, things like our campgrounds at state parks, our boat ramps at popular lakes. But we also own and manage a lot of less obvious types of infrastructure, such as monitoring wells that help us collect and provide critical groundwater data to make water use decisions across our state. We manage water control structures, and you can think of some of the obvious larger dam structures, but some of these are also small on smaller shallow lakes that help us manage those lakes for waterfall and other wildlife. And each one of these assets is more than just its physical structure. It really is something that means an experience or a quality of life to Minnesotans. So think about State Park Campground or the cabin, not just as a building, but that place where Minnesotans and visitors spend their precious family vacation. You could think about a fishing pier, again, not as just a group of boards and metal constructed together, but it's a place where a child, a Minnesotan, catches their first fish. And our fish hatcheries are the places where those fish are raised so that those children can catch those fish. Even our DNR offices, of course, they are important places where our employees work, but they're also the places where the public can come to buy a fishing license, to apply for a permit, get their information on natural resources in their community. And so these assets, each and every one of them in their diversity, has a particular meaning to Minnesotans. Our asset portfolio is also very expanse in its geographic distribution. We have assets in all 87 counties in Minnesota. That includes 5.6 million acres of land, nearly 3,000 buildings. Within those buildings, there are 234 work sites where our employees report to work. And if you took each one of those buildings and broke them down into their individual components, the electrical system, the HVAC system, the roofs, the windows, we have about 30,000 building components to manage across the state of Minnesota. The value of all of these assets in replacement value is $3.5 billion. So this represents an incredible investment that we are managing for the state of Minnesota. I would also be remiss if I didn't note we also have $778 million of deferred maintenance on that $3.5 billion asset. And so we'll talk about how we tackle that. Similar, I think more similar to the stories you will hear, certainly we heard that from the agencies that came before us today, that infrastructure is aging. At DNR, we're actually aging. We're past the age a little bit more than the average of other state buildings. The average statewide is 41 years. We're at 46 years for the average age of our building. And you can, you know, this isn't really a surprise when you think about the fact that our state park system is the second oldest state park system in the country. And that's really something to be proud of. Minnesota's been a leader, but it also means that infrastructure was designed and built for a different generation than we're serving today. I know that this committee in a prior configuration has been to see our fish hatcheries, particularly Waterville. Those hatcheries were constructed in the 1950s, and we are still using the same equipment to raise fish today. I know you've been to Bajura, some of you. That nursery has been growing trees since 1931. Some of you still saw the cold storage has been there being used since 1931. And our seed processing equipment is 30 years old now. These are really important assets and facilities that produce not only experiences and recreational quality, but economic activity for the state of Minnesota. And we're really behind in terms of the state of the art. So as you can imagine, managing a portfolio of nearly 3,000 buildings, 30,000 building components, all 87 counties, this really requires something beyond a project-by-project approach. We can't be here requesting dollars for every window, every roof, even every building. And so what we have done at the department is to develop a systematic, programmatic approach. And you should all have in your packet, I know those of you who have sat on this committee for a while are familiar with our 10-year capital asset needs report. This one is hot off the press. We update it every other year. Ms. Minkler and her team do a fabulous job of inventorying each of our capital assets and its condition status, and then recalculating what it takes on an annual basis. And so that's how we're able to come up with our current deferred maintenance and develop a list of our most critical priorities. So in order to approach this programmatically, we focus on three key areas of investment. This is what you will see in our proposal: preserving and rehabilitating our existing assets. This is our natural resources asset preservation program. It's about taking care of what we have. There's programmatic investments in our public lands and facilities to meet current and future needs. Again, not just the needs of things that were designed for a previous generation, but those going forward. And then a programmatic focus around community grants to enhance community well-being across Minnesota. So we'll give a brief overview then. I will transition from the context to our 2023 bonding request. In his One Minnesota budget, the governor has recommended $265.7 million of investment. These bonding investments, which are summarized here in this pie chart, will advance the DNR's mission and address critical issues such as improving access to the outdoors, advancing safety and community well-being, and rehabilitating aging and in some cases, failing infrastructure. This next slide is a text version of the pie chart, but gives a listing of both the programmatic as well as those grant programs, our requests. So these investments, again, allow us to take care of what we have in terms of our existing infrastructure. They enhance connections to the outdoors for Minnesota's children and families. They help us mitigate and adapt to a changing climate. They support natural resource-based economies for the benefits of all Minnesotans. They ensure efficient, safe operations for the department, and they support public health and safety. I'll go through each of the three programmatic areas briefly. That first is preserving and rehabilitating existing assets. Again, we manage nearly $3.5 billion in built assets for the benefit of all Minnesotans. And through these assets, whether they are buildings and their individual building components, whether they are those public water accesses, which is the means by which people access our amazing water resources, whether they are the forest roads, trails that people hike, our fish hatcheries. Again, these assets are more than just their built infrastructure. They connect Minnesotans with our outdoors. They support our communities and conserve our natural heritage. Investing in public lands to meet current and future needs. In this category, these are investments such as modernizing our existing facility and investing in new facilities. So I talked about the State Forest Nursery and the Waterville Fish Hatchery. This would also include our Drill Corps Library in Hibbing. This category, this programmatic area is also used to acquire high priority parcels and improve existing state lands. Within this is our reforestation, new shore fishing opportunities that we're looking to create for Minnesotans who don't have the opportunity to access fishing opportunities via boat. Shore fishing is an important way to do that, and enhanced access to all of our public lands. There are comprehensive accessibility improvements contained in this budget. I'd be happy to talk more about those, but that's really been a focus and priority for us to make sure that not just minimal compliance with ADA is achieved at our sites, but that we're really making that experience, the essence of the experience, that unique Minnesota outdoor experience, accessible. And then this also includes continued development of the Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park, our newest state park in Minnesota, and we're still fulfilling the promise of developing the vision of that park. And then our community grants are also an important programmatic component. I know many of you are familiar with our flood hazard mitigation program, our parks and trails local and regional grants, and our community tree planting grants. These programs allow the DNR to partner with our local communities to develop parks and trails, to help create a network of close-to-home recreation opportunities, and address local needs consistent with state priorities. They help build stewardship across the state, and they're also, I think, very economical in the partnership. If you look just at the flood hazard mitigation, for every dollar we spend on mitigation, we avoid $7 in future damages. And then just before we conclude, I want to just take a moment and highlight our Get Out More initiative. This is modernizing outdoor recreation experiences. This initiative is funded, you'll see from this chart, both out of recommendations in the governor's budget of general fund as well as bonding dollars. And again, that's because we're focused on that whole outdoor recreation experience, some of which relates to capital infrastructure, and some of which doesn't. So if you think about our state parks, obviously the road access, the trails, the buildings, those are capital infrastructure. When you go to think about some of the equipment we use to make those sites welcoming and accessible, like the track chairs, the all-terrain track chairs that we rolled out last summer at 5 state parks, you think about our wayfinding, the signage so that people don't get lost, those items are not bondable. And so we didn't want to make a choice about which elements of creating that experience were more important than others. And so this is really a comprehensive look to make sure that we're enhancing access and welcoming new users to all of our public lands, to modernize our camping and camping-related infrastructure, to modernize our boating access and infrastructure, to enhance our fisheries and fishing infrastructure, and then to restore streams and modernize our water-related infrastructure. And so again, this is more than just repairing what was envisioned a generation ago. This is really about modernizing the system and positioning it to serve Minnesotans today and for the future. So in summary, hopefully you will have seen that DNR is responsible for extensive capital assets and some really important ones, both built and natural, and it is more than just the physical structure. It is what that physical structure means to Minnesotans. That infrastructure is really important. If we're going to preserve that those experiences, we've got to enhance and renew this infrastructure, and that is going to require significant ongoing investment. And with that, Mr. Chair, Ms. Minkler and I are happy to stand for any questions.
Commissioner, can you just confirm for the Get Out More slide piece, the general fund that you have on here, is it within the governor's recommendation for the capital budget, or is that under the DNR operating budget that those general fund items will be located?
Mr. Chair, the column that is titled General Fund, of totaling $118 million, that is in the governor's general fund budget, the operating budget for the department. And then coincidentally, the capital request also totals $118 million. That is the piece that is in the governor's capital request. So the two add together from different sources.
Thank you. And then, Commissioner, can you just remind the committee, what is the difference between the natural resources, asset preservation, and betterment of buildings? I know that a lot of our members ask about this all the time.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Do you want to take that?
Sure.
Okay. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Sure. Samantha Minkler, Mr. Chair and committee members. The NRAP Preservation Fund is for preserving what we already have, and the betterment is for modernizing facilities or building new facilities.
Thank you. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to welcome Sarah Stroman to our committee. She's a constituent of mine, and she's doing excellent work. And also, being the first-time member, I didn't appreciate what an expansive portfolio you have. I mean, you're going to give DHS a run for its money. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you were a constituent of hers at one time, no? Ramsey? No, okay.
Nope.
I moved.
Big district, okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Commissioner, first I want to thank you. This is a big budget. This is big everywhere. But representing Northern Minnesota, we're on here a fair amount, and it proves that the rest of the state uses us. I mean, they come up and use us a lot, and there's a lot of asset preservation here, and there's also trail money somewhere in our budget somewhere here. So I just want to bring it out and let everyone know, you know, I mean, this is something that the people in Northern Minnesota, request, but I'm getting a mind block here. We really appreciate the governor and you showing that we need these projects to keep going. Because the experience that people have when they leave, wherever they come from, when they come to our area, whether it's in International Falls or Grand Marais or Split Rock, wherever it is, Minnesota always leads, and we are number two, so we appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, thanks for coming today. Just today we had a presentation on Parks and Trails and the Legacy Committee, and you were well represented there. I guess generally I have a request for you, since we have three chairs that are pertinent to your area of work, and if you were to sit down with Chair Lee and Chair Hansen and myself and others and just kind of strategize, because there's just so much overlap, and I'm really not sure who is funding what and what's going to which. You get funds, I know, through LCCMR, which is in Hanson's, and the Environment Bill through Hanson's, and then now through this committee, and then through Lassard Sam's, and then through the Parks and Trails. So anyways, there's a bit of a confusion, and then it just, I kind of would prefer if we were to fund some of these things that I think you are funding through Legacy. I think it makes sense to fund through this bill, buildings and roofs, and that we are able to do more programming in Legacy and that sort of thing, and getting people out on the trails, like the ICANN program, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's a request that you meet with us soon.
Mr. Stroman.
Mr. Chair and Chair Lilly, we would be happy to do that. The reality is for us is, and I think this is relatively new, and this is what we've tried to explain with our Get Out More, we really focused on what is the final vision we have for our capital assets, as well as if we could do the same for our parks, the rest of our public lands, and then we went through and fit the funding source. What is appropriate for capital funding? What is appropriate for general fund? What is appropriate for legacy? And so we sort of have that back of the house, match to funding, and what we put forward is the vision. So I think that's a really good idea to sit down with the three chairs and make sure that you understand how we get to that complete vision with each of those various funding sources.
Thank you, Commissioner Stroman. Thank you for coming before the committee. Next on the agenda, we'll move to the Department of Military Affairs, Major General Mankey, and Director Don Kurt. Welcome to the committee, Major General and Director. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Major General Sean Mankey. I'm the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard. And with me today, I have Mr. Don Kerr. He's the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. And thank you for having us here today, Mr. Chair and committee members. We're going to talk about the capital bonding request for the Department of Military Affairs, which is funding for modernization of our Rosemont, Moorhead, Fergus Falls, and Rosemont Readiness Centers. And Mr. Kerr will take you through more of the specifics of that, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Major General. Director, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. Really appreciate the committee having us today. The good news, bad news is this will be pretty simple, because all we're really doing is requesting the projects that we requested last year, with a little bit of inflation that we have worked through. So the number is larger, and I will apologize a little bit. On this slide, it shows a $6.7 million amount for a group of projects. And in consultation with MMB, we think we're going to split those back out to the individual projects. The vast amount of increase happens in the Marshall Readiness Center. We've already moved forward with Fergus Falls and Moorhead, and we've used some of our operational funding to make up the shortfall that we were seeing. So we'll continue with those, and we'll get those done. But we do need a plus-up for the Marshall Readiness Center. And, of course, the bottom line for Rosemont has grown substantially as we've gotten into the design phase of that and identified some things. So that's the bottom line numbers. I'm going to go ahead to the talk briefly about what we generally come to the bonding committee for. Normally, our agency does routine maintenance on our facilities based on the money that we get in our operational budget, which is about $9 million a year from the state. That's matched with federal funding. That comes in various fashions from the federal government. And so we do have some asset preservation, if you will, that we do internally. But because we have about 60 armories in our fleet that need to be maintained, we've identified that, realistically, we have to get into every one of them about every 20 years and put on a roof and windows and electrical upgrades and that type of thing. And so with 60 in the fleet, that means we need to be doing about 3 a year. And that's kind of what our proposal is. So we're still a little bit behind in getting to those 3 a year. The number is just a little bit lower than that, though, because we have some facilities that we have identified that we are not going to continue to invest in. So that changes the math a little bit, why we can get off of that cycle and still be okay. But typically, when we do a batch project, these are the types of things that we go in and do. So the Rosemont Readiness Center is the biggest one. That's our facility that used to house the 34th Division headquarters. Now we've moved the 1st Brigade of the 34th Division into that facility since we built a new one for the division. This is a big renovation. It's one of the first really large buildings that we built. And what we're finding, of course, is that as we get through and complete the maintenance tasks to cycle through our 1950s and our 1960s armories, now we're getting into the 1980s and 1990s, and they're a lot bigger, and they require a lot more money. And that's one of the reasons that we're here with this relatively large ask. So this is an additional $24.7 million in addition to the million we've already received for Rosemont. I'm going to move quickly. The Moorhead Readiness Center is actually another one of our large armories. The cost isn't quite as high on this one, and we are moving forward with this renovation. It's in progress right now. So the supplemental amount that we were looking for is $855,000. The Marshall Readiness Center is a project we haven't been able to start yet. As we rank ordered these, even though Marshall was higher on the list, we did the math of what funds we had available based on the bonding that was approved in 2020 and decided to hold Marshall till the end. We are in a little bit of danger with this one because we had federal funding approved for this, and we asked the feds to delay it a year to allow us to do this catch-up, and they have so far been amenable to that. We have some concerns of if we don't get this project moving this year, we're at risk of losing the matching federal funding. We'll have to start the process over again. We could probably still get that, but it would cause a hiccup and delay the rest of our renovation projects. And then the Fergus Falls Readiness Center, we're almost complete with this one, but we are looking for an additional $800,000 to complete this project as we desire. Again, Mr. Chair, that is our bottom line. $6.767 million in the projects that were approved in 2020 and the additional $24.7 for Rosemont to complete that project. And that will catch us up with where we need to be, all set to come in with next year's bonding in June. Subject to your questions, Mr. Chair, that completes our presentation.
So, Director, just for the facilities that you have decided that you're not going to invest in, are you going to close operations totally, or is it just that you're not going to invest in that facility?
Mr. Chair, it depends. So the federal government directed us to do a long-range study. We did that about 15 years ago. It was something called the RCTMP, the Readiness Center Transformation Master Plan. And we completed that work, and it opened our eyes to a number of things. Mostly that we're in too many places and we can't afford to stay in all the places that we are, and we're going to have to do some divestiture. And it forced us to look at the existing fleet that we had, the inventory that we had, look at properties where we have the ability to expand because we have the land in some cases, or the other circumstances are appropriate, and in places where we can't because we're landlocked, being surrounded by urban sprawl. And we have made some decisions with regard to timing. And most of those cases, they're tied to timing of new federal construction. So we have been very successful in getting 100% federal funding for a number of new armories, for example, in Stillwater, and a number that we built at Arden Hills. Those were 100% federally funded. We're about to get started on building a federal armory in New Ulm. And as we build a new armory in New Ulm, obviously we'll divest of the old one. So we'll be, that building's currently 100 years old, has a lot of challenges that will be no longer a problem because we'll divest of that facility. But some we are literally, they're on the list for us to divest of, but we don't have a firm plan of what that timing looks like. Because again, a lot of these are tied to federal construction projects where we're trying to do renovations or additions to existing structures that will allow us to close others. And to make it even more complicated, the feds have just approved a brand new contract to redo the RCTMP. And so we're in the contracting stage of that right now. The feds will pay for that 100%, but they'll bring a team in and they will have us relook one more time and give us some recommendations as to where we probably need to move. A lot of that will be tied to the demographer's findings about what the population of Minnesota is doing. But there are some operational considerations that could override that. We will wind up staying in some places where maybe the growing population doesn't support it, but we need to have a place to operate in that region. So that was a probably overcomplicated answer to a simple question.
Thank you, Director. I see no members' questions. Thank you, Director, and thank you, Major General, for coming before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Last of the agenda for today will be the Department of Education. We have Assistant Commissioner Burnham. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed. Please identify yourself and proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Teaching and Learning of Department of Education, of which the State Library Services Division is located. Today I'm here to talk to you about the Public Library Construction Grant Program. And just a little historical numbers around this, the public library system in the state. We have 12 regional public library systems with 355 library locations. This includes 9 bookmobiles. There is at least one public library in every county. And we included some 2021 usage numbers in this slide. We do not have 2022 usage numbers available until April of 23, but you can see those 21 numbers also include 10,000 in-person children events in addition to those 9.7 million visits in 2021 and those 40 million items borrowed and over 37,000 community meetings taking place in our public libraries. So you can see that the value in the public library system around just these 2020 usage numbers. The library system directors report a surge in patrons wanting to borrow items, attend in-person programming, and access technology in person. So we expect these 2022 numbers to be see a nice increase in those as well. In thinking about this public library construction grant program, what we're hearing is the need for air handling and HVAC systems updates is very high. So the library construction grant program has two project types. The eligible applicants are cities, counties, and regional public library systems. The improvement project type includes new construction, renovation of existing library facilities, repair of existing library facilities, which means typically leaky roofs, weathered brickwork, etc. The accessibility projects include mediation of physical barriers preventing access for all, which includes automatic doors, ADA-compliant restrooms, and upgrading the lighting system. Pictured here is the Kimball Public Library, which was awarded $440,000 back in 2019 for construction of a new facility, which increased from 1,010 square feet to 4,200 square feet. The grant program requires a minimum match, local match of 50% of project costs, and it goes through the competitive peer review process. Program data for the public library system, ever for this grant program, the appropriations range from $1 million to $2.95 million. There have been 170 awards in its lifespan. The average award is just over $107,000. The largest was $1 million in 2018 to Fergus Falls, and the smallest was $614 in 1996 to White Bear Lake. The average local match is just over $6 per every dollar of the state. The last appropriation was 2.95 in October of 2020. Libraries in 70 of the 87 counties have applied for and received grants. 40 projects total in the 7 county metro and 130 projects in greater Minnesota. The 2023 recommendation from the governor's office is 1.2 million. Historically, 17.8 in grant funds has drawn nearly 112 million in local support. A prospective city, which means a city employee, a county employee, or a library employee, has emailed or contacted the State Library Services team with questions about whether there'll be grant funds available. So, given those contacts, the cities listed under prospective cities are those who have contacted State Library Services about this grant program. The Council of Regional Public Library Systems Administrators collects data for public library capital investment needs each year. So the governor is recommending $1.2 million for library construction competitive grant program. This program enables public libraries receiving funding to improve access and meet ADA compliance standards by removing architectural barriers and replacing deficient facilities. And with that is the public library competitive grant program for facilities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any questions for the commissioner? Representative Carroll.
I think I know the answer to this, but I'm asking anyway. So this is for public libraries, correct?
Correct. Commissioner. Oh,
so
I'm sorry.
Each county has a law library. Does it include law libraries?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, that is a good question, and I don't have the answer in front of me right now. But we will find out and get back to you.
Okay. Representative Carroll.
Thank you. I just met with some folks this morning regarding funding for that, and I always thought it was the responsibility of the county, perhaps participation of the state, but I wasn't sure, so I'd appreciate some response. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carroll. And Commissioner, if you could see if you can find that information, send it to the committee administrator. We'll send it out to the committee. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Commissioner, for coming by. Members, that wraps up all of our state agencies' requests from the governor's committee budget. Our next meeting is on Monday, February 3rd. Please keep an eye out for a notification from the committee administrator. With that, the meeting is adjourned.